All right, we're in 1 Kings chapter 10 this morning. 1 Kings chapter 10. We finished up in 1 Kings chapter 9 last week, and it's kind of a summary of a lot of the works of Solomon. I left the map up here to begin with because we're going to review this, because some of the things that we're talking about today of the Queen of Sheba. But the Queen of Sheba here, there's two basic areas that have been proposed. Both of them would be down a ways on the Red Sea. Josephus says it was what was then called Ethiopia, which would have been on, you know, this portion of Africa. But I think I lean towards the other commentators that say it was more on the southern tip of Arabia here, which would be more what would be modern-day Yemen. That, you know, this is a screenshot of Google Maps here. But you have names that you've heard over the last 15 or 20 years on this map, right? Yemen, Oman, United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Iran. You know, that's all familiar territory, right? But Yemen, which is on the tip of the Arabian Peninsula here, I think it's very likely that Sheba is in this general region. Either way, it would have been on, you know, one side or the other of the Red Sea, and it was a very long land journey from either direction. It was a very long land journey up here to where Solomon was. So, when Solomon gets a visit from the Queen of Sheba, you're talking about a journey of 1,000, 1,200 miles, more than likely, for her to come and visit Solomon. Now, if you were going to take a 1,000-mile trip, and many of you have, the Tooks have come further than that from their house to here, from their home to here. But, you know, if you're going to take a journey of 1,000 miles, how are you calculating that? Okay, on average about this many miles, you know, in an hour or so, this might take me, what, you know, 15 hours, 16 hours, okay? Depending on who's driving, maybe 12 and a half, you know. But, you know, we tend to calculate it in those terms. But if this journey is 1,000, 1,200 miles, either trying to follow the coastline to follow supplies or the trade routes, and you've got a lot of desert involved, very often when they traveled by camel, the camels were more suitable for the desert, both because of their ability to store water, but also their feet many times were better equipped to handle the hot sand and all of that. But a camel, they were doing well to make 20, maybe 30 miles a day, which, you know, we're told that in Bible times, in Jesus' day, they could make usually 20 miles a day on foot, you know, on the roads and such. But, you know, just in terms of that, if they could make 30 miles a day, how long was the trip at, you know, 1,000 to 1,200 miles, 30 miles a day? You know, we're talking 30 to 40 days one way, right? So this was 30 days up and 30 days back. So this was not just a whim. Oh, yeah, let's go ride the Blue Ridge Parkway this afternoon. You know, from here, we're close enough that we can access it and go take a ride. This wasn't, oh, we want a store other than Walmart. Let's go to Gastonia or Greenville. You know, that's not what we do in Shelby here. This was not just a whim. This was a significant undertaking, is what I'm saying, okay? And why specifically did she come? Chapter 10, verse 1 says, she'd heard the fame of Solomon concerning the name of the Lord, and she came to prove him with hard questions, okay? So her location, we've talked about it, in the region of modern-day Yemen, in the southern portion of the Arabian Peninsula. That is in some resources called Arabia Felix. That was the old name for it. What was her motivation? You notice there in verse 1, she had heard the fame of Solomon concerning the name of the Lord. Now, I don't think that this definitively proves that she was seeking the God of Israel. I don't think this is necessarily an Ethiopian eunuch type situation. Remember, the Ethiopian eunuch came looking for answers, and Philip met him, and he says, who are you reading about? I don't know. Can you help me? Well, this one, you remember, what was Solomon's most well-known building? It's a temple. Okay, and it was a house for the name of who? The Lord, Jehovah. Yeah, and this when Solomon started out, he said, "I'm this house which I build to the name of the Lord is to be exceeding magnificent, and it's to be a reputation to all the known world." Well, how did somebody 1,000 miles away, no electronic communications, no modern day travel, how long do you think it took for people 1,000, 1,200 miles away to hear about Solomon's temple? Things would travel, but not as quickly as we would think about. It wasn't on the evening news. It wasn't on the internet. It wasn't in newspapers. It was a different time. But Sheba was part of a trade, the regular trade routes. You see, verse number 2, she came to Jerusalem with a very great train, camels that bear spices, gold, precious stones. Okay, those were things that were very much traded on the regular routes of commerce. And, being on the Red Sea, whichever side of that she was on, that was part of the trade route, both for land and for ports, for ships. Okay? The spices, however, were most commonly found in the east, in the direction of India. And the point is that on those trade routes, there would be people that were going up as far as Egypt, or maybe they went into Israel, and then they would see and hear things, and then they'd bring back reports, and those things would spread. But we're very likely at this point we're talking about the midpoint of Solomon's reign, probably, because when she came and he showed off everything, Solomon's house was built. Everything was established. She saw his ascent to the house of the Lord, which was the travel connection between Solomon's house and the temple. So all those things were established. So this is likely at the 20-year point or a little after, when all of Solomon's major building projects have been finished. That makes sense? But nonetheless, you have the Queen of Sheba comes to visit, but she come concerning the name of the Lord. I think that she had heard about this house that was built in their apparel and his cupbearers and his ascent by which he went up into the house of the Lord. So this is kind of a summary of everything that she saw. When she came, she asked Solomon her questions. She then got the royal tour of all of these things. But people, that's part of why Solomon had so much food prepared every day. He had people from everywhere, not to mention his collection of women, which we'll get to in the next chapter. We're not told how many children he had, but at this point, by the time Solomon was done, how many women had he collected? And I'm sorry to say it that way, but that's just kind of the way it was. How many had he collected? 1,000. 700 wives, 300 cucumber concubines, okay? He had 1,000 women plus children. So if you're going to have family dinner, you're feeding 1,000 people, not counting anybody else that's there. Now, family dinner, 700 wives competing for the attention of one man. I'm sure that was a peaceful event, right? All right, I digress. I'll leave that for the next chapter. But the point is, the Queen of Sheba saw all of this, the food, the way all the arrangement was made, even the apparel, the uniforms, the royal attire, the cupbearers. And it seems like it wasn't just the king that had cupbearers, but likely his ministers, his officers, they had their own personal cupbearers as well. We're told a little bit later on down here in chapter 10, I believe it's verse 21, all King Solomon's drinking vessels were of gold, and all the vessels of the house of the forest of Lebanon were pure gold. The house of the forest of Lebanon was his mountain house. Okay? He had his main house in Jerusalem, then he had his mountain house. They were all of pure gold, none were of silver. Now, I don't know how many of you still do this, but some of you remember grandma's house. If it was a fancy occasion, it's Thanksgiving, it's Christmas dinner, it's Easter dinner, grandma might get out the real what? China, and then what kind of utensils? The real silver. My grandma Hanky had real silver. and of thy wisdom. Howbeit, I believed not the words until I came and mine own eyes had seen it. I like that. Okay, I hear what you're saying, but I want to see it for myself. And verse, middle of verse 7, plenty. I mean, if she's seen the house, she's seen everything was gold plated. She's seen that his dishes were gold, not silver. Why does he need gifts? I mean, that was their custom. Okay, it was customary to bring a gift to the ruler, to the other royal. And you know, history and tradition tells us that typically the gifts that they would bring would represent the best things from their own home country. Okay, it would those things that were special, or those things that were the peculiar treasures. I mean, any of you ever observe when a missionary comes back to the States and they bring things that are representative of that country? Brother Lockhart, you made a trip to Brazil about a month ago. You brought some things back, right? You brought some things for your kids or some friends that were unique to Brazil, right? Ariana, you bring things from Italy or get excited when you can find things that are, you know, like home here. Sure. I think when your dad went back for the Bible conference in December, I think he brought some things back from Italy, right? Yeah, and so sometimes it's just to say, hey, I want to share with you the good things from my country, right? But there's a part of me that says, why do you need to give Solomon gifts? He's the man. If there ever was the man that had everything, it was Solomon. But this was partly cultural, partly, you know, an acknowledgement of friendship and so forth. But in verse 10, what did she give him? 120 talents of gold, because he didn't have any. No, but that was one of the things that Sheba had a supply of, was gold. Okay, the other thing that she gave was spices, very great store, and precious stones. I'll notice the next statement. There came no more such abundance of spices as these which the queen of Sheba gave to King Solomon. In other words, this was the largest supply in one place, was this. So, again, that tells us that the trade routes through her area, these were accessible. These were valued. They were not easy to come by. And so it wasn't like she gave a little, you know, McCormick shaker of whatever, right? I mean, we're talking about bundles in large quantities, and it was the real thing. It wasn't mostly MSG, okay? These were actual spices. And so she gave a tremendous supply of that, and then the precious stones that she gave to King Solomon. Now, if you drop down, there's kind of a parenthetical here in verses 11 and 12. We'll come back to that, but look at verse 13. King Solomon gave unto the queen of Sheba all her desire, whatsoever she asked, beside that which Solomon gave her of his royal bounty. So you ever have an invited guest and, you know, you give them a little gift? I mean, when we have invited speakers come to the church, a lot of times we have a little gift basket for them, whether it's got fruit or snack foods or things like that, or maybe, you know, small gifts. Solomon's gift bag was better than anything that we could put together, right? And so he had a royal gift for her too. But then it's very interesting. He gave her whatsoever she asked. So in other words, could I have a place setting from your house to take? Oh, yeah, sure. Take a dozen so you have a full set, you know. You know, could I have a uniform from one of your servants? I want to see if I can have my tailors make something for that. Sure. Whatever she asked for, Solomon gave her. Solomon wasn't all that worried about running out, right? So she was able to just go and ask for. Ladies, wouldn't that be a fun shopping trip? Yeah. Not only that, it's nicer than any store we shop in. But what was the price tag on this? Free, 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 right? So yeah, that was a kind of a neat little statement that we sometimes almost pass over, but there was basically the exchange of royal gifts here. And then no doubt when she went home, she's still talking about this, right? Are you not going to believe this? I saw this from my own eyes. I asked him these questions and he answered me, and look at this. I mean, this is what they eat. This isn't Thanksgiving and Christmas or whatever their holidays were. Some of the commentators say that this people that are associated with Sheba may be people that are also called the Sabaeans in other places in the Old Testament. But, you know, regardless, you know, she had these things that she took home, the gifts from Solomon as well to show. And you have show and tell? Well, let me show you. I made a trip to Israel. Let me show you what I got from Solomon's house. You know, anyway, this was her astonishment and then, you know, her departure. All right. So then verses 11 and 12 and then really the rest of the chapter, we see Solomon's trade, his wealth, and his splendor. It's almost like in verse 10, the supplies that the Queen of Sheba brought, the gold and the spices and the precious stones, it's almost like that jogged the memory of the writer here, and then he jumped over to verses 11 and 12 talking about other things before he went back to the Queen of Sheba. 11 and 12, he says, the navy of Hiram that brought gold from Ophir brought in from Ophir great plenty of almug trees and precious stones. And the king made of the almug trees pillars for the house of the Lord and for the king's house, harps also and psalteries for singers. There came no such almug trees, nor were seen unto this day. So you had treasures from Ophir. You had gold and almug trees. What is an almug tree? Oh, great. I'll look up the word and see what the word means. Here's what I found out when I looked up the Hebrew word. Almug is a transliteration into English of the Hebrew letters. You take the Hebrew letters and give them their English equivalent, it's almug. That doesn't help me at all. So maybe the translators weren't really sure either, you know. It's just a transliteration to English. The commentators, one of the most frequent ideas that's given is that possibly that is sandalwood trees. Those were very fragrant. They were very rare. Those also were more abundant in the east, you know, from the direction of India and China and points east from Israel. But it says that this was a unique supply. These things were not native to Israel. It was imported wood. If we're, you know, that's a term that you might hear today. And then he made decorative items for his house and the temple, and he also made instruments. I don't know if any of you are that into the, you know, the making of stringed instruments, but you know, you get somebody that's invested a lot of time in it and they pay a lot of attention to it. You know, Drew, does it matter what kind of wood your violin or viola is made out of? Sure it does. You know, and if you get it one made out of a higher quality of wood, the price about four or five times, right? It jumps way up in a hurry. So in essence, what's being said here is this wood was ideal for certain kinds of stringed instruments. And Solomon used it, had instruments made out of some of this. But this is connected with the navy. Remember we showed you on the map at the beginning that Hiram had helped Solomon make a navy and they launched it on the Red Sea and that went out to points east. Well, he had other ships on the Mediterranean that went to points west. But we're told in the parallel account in Chronicles that these ships here returned, you know, every 3 years, and we'll see that, you know, towards the end of chapter 10 here as well. But you have Solomon's trade, so you have the treasures from Ophir. Now look at verse 14. You have the gold. The weight of the gold that came to Solomon in 1 year was 666 talents of gold. 666. There's no demonic significance here. 666 talents of gold. That's 26 tons. Or using the same numbers I gave you a few weeks ago when we talked about the temple, that's almost $1.5 billion just in gold a year. Now, this would include the gold that came from Ophir with his naval ships. This would include the 120 talents that, you know, the Queen of Sheba brought. This would include his tax money from other regions, his other enterprises that made him money, right? This is kind of a summary of all of his income from all the various sources. Any of you ever had, all of you have had to put that together recently? What's your total income? And you'll get all your statements and receipts together and all that kind of stuff. Or you got to do it between now and the middle of April, right? Well, his income was just in gold was this much, not counting silver, precious stones, spices, any other merchandise that was sold. Verse 15, beside that he had of the merchantmen and of the traffic of the spice merchants and of all the kings of Arabia and of the governors of the country. So the kings of Arabia, that would include tribute money from all these other places. It was during the time of Solomon that Israel came the closest to ruling over all the area that God had promised them. Because God had promised David that, you know, his seed would cover from Israel to the river Euphrates. Okay. Well, in the time of Solomon, all of that area brought tribute to him. They acknowledged him. They, you know, submitted to him. They didn't want to fight him. He didn't necessarily occupy and control all those countries, but they were tributaries. So that promise still hasn't been completely fulfilled. When will that be fulfilled? Well, in the millennial kingdom, when Jesus Christ, the Son of David, rules in Jerusalem. Well, at that point, it'll be fully fulfilled. But I'm just saying those kinds of tribute monies would be counted in, you know, all of this total income. So you see the gold and the spices. Then you see the golden shields, verse 16. King Solomon made 200 targets of beaten gold. 600 shekels went to one target. Verse 17, he made 300 shields. Now, when we think target, we think, you know, an object at which to shoot. But these words, targets and shields, these are two different words that both refer to shields. The first one in verse 16 would refer to tall shields. It would basically be a full body shield. Okay? If you've done any, you know, historical study on Rome, you know that certain units in their army had basically these full body shields, and some of them they could interlink them together and almost make it like a turtle shell, so to speak. The front line, they would interlock them together, and the rows behind, they would hold them over their head. And so whatever arrows or projectiles were thrown at them, you know, they were protected. But these were more for decoration. I mean, the normal pattern was these would be a wood shield that were overlaid with leather. In certain cases, the leather could be wet with water to help put out a flaming arrow. Even the New Testament talks about the fiery darts of the wicked, right? But these would have been that same basic pattern, but they were overlaid with gold. So they took this amount of gold and they beat it out into thin plate, and then it was basically hammered work that would overlay these shields. Some of them were in Jerusalem. Some of them were in the house of the forest of Lebanon. These were mostly ceremonial. I did think about it, though. I mean, if you did take those to the battlefield, there would be a certain strategic advantage if you can catch the sun just right. Put the sun back in the eyes of your opponents. Maybe that could help you. But these were primarily ceremonial. But the ones in verse 16 are more full-body shields. In verse 17, these were the smaller shields that you might think of that a soldier would have on one arm and a sword or a spear in the other arm. Okay, but these were covered with gold. I mean, when you can have gold-plated weaponry and body armor, you're wealthy. That's what Solomon had here. So you have the golden shields. And then in beginning in verse 18, we have his throne, his grand throne. Verse 18, moreover, the king made a great throne of ivory and overlaid it with the best gold. Now, we see, drop down to verse 22 for a minute. The king had at sea a navy of Tarshish. Now, Tarshish is the other way, Italy, Spain, it's across the Mediterranean. I don't think these items came from that direction. I just think that some of the sailors were there, like Hiram sent his sailors and shipbuilders. And I think the ships were built more on a Tarshish-type pattern than on other patterns. But I think these are the ships that Hiram and Solomon launched that went out the Red Sea and came back every so often. Verse 22, king had at sea a navy of Tarshish with the navy of Hiram. Once in 3 years came the navy of Tarshish, bringing gold, silver, and what's the next word? Ivory, apes, peacocks. Okay? So he had a zoo, you know, an animal farm for beauty and appearance and show off and all that, that nobody else had. So they were importing wild animals from all over the place, but they also were importing ivory. Now, I don't think back in verse 18, he had a great throne of ivory. I don't think the entire thing was made of ivory, like all the steps and everything else. I think the seat was made of ivory. It's possible there were ivory inlays in other parts, but the seat, you know, maybe the seat in the back, that kind of thing, but the rest of it, I don't know if that was all made of ivory or not. The throne had six steps, and the top of the throne was round behind. Okay, so it seems like maybe it was a circular dais or platform. It's possible there was also kind of a circular shade that was behind it as well. There were stays on either side of the place of the seat. I think today we would call that armrests. You know, it's a stay. It's a place to put your arms or to rest. verse 20, and 12 lions stood on one side and the other side upon the six steps. It says two lions stood beside the staves. So you had the throne of Solomon and you had two lions on either side. Many of the commentators think that these were life-size replicas, okay, not small, you know, gift shop-type lions, okay? You had two on either side. Well, then you had six steps to get up to the main platform, and on each side there was a lion on step one, lion on step two on either side, so that's where you're 12, six on each side on the six steps leading up to this platform. More than likely, the lions, they're not solid gold here. I think they're overlaid with gold. Wood carving of exquisite craftsmanship. I mean, what was in the temple? What was carved on the wood in the temple? Palm trees and flowers and angels and all kinds of things. So, I mean, they had the carvers and the woodworkers to do this kind of stuff. So they had these, you know, life-size lions, and then this is all overlaid with gold. This is just, you know, incredible. That's why verse 20 tells us there was not the like made in any kingdom. You know, there's nothing like this in the world at the time of Solomon. This was just an example of his wealth and his time. He had the peacetime to do this, all right? So you have his grand throne. Verse 21, we already talked about the vessels of gold. Verse 22, the king had at sea a navy that brought back gold, silver, ivory, and apes, and it came back in once in 3 years. Well, that makes sense based on the distances they might have to travel. I mean, we're not talking about diesel-powered tankers. We're not talking about cargo ships. What were the two primary ways of propelling these ships in their day? Manpower? What was the other one? Wind power. Okay, so if they were going to travel all the way down the Red Sea and then east out through what we would call the Arabian Sea, maybe the Indian Ocean, but, you know, out that way, how long would it take them to make that trip? You know, so to go that far and come back, it makes some sense that they came back every third year and they collected all of these things, you know, in the meantime. All right, and then you have the rest of this. I just summarize it as his trade and tourists, okay? Verse 23, Solomon exceeded all the kings of the earth for riches and for wisdom, and all the earth sought to Solomon to hear his wisdom. That's the tourists. That's all the people that came to visit, okay? All the earth sought to Solomon to hear his wisdom, which God had put in his heart, and they brought every man his present. In some cases, it might be tribute. In some cases, it's just a sign of respect. Vessels of silver, gold, garments, armor, spices, horses, mules, a rate year by year. That year by year rate makes it sound like tribute. Queen of Sheba, this was a royal gift, but the other ones year by year, that would have been the tribute that was required. We see that later on when Israel's conquered. They had to pay that same kind of tribute money to their conquering enemies as well. Verse 26, we see the navy, you see the tribute, then you see the horses. Verse 26, Solomon gathered together chariots and horsemen, and he had 1,400 chariots. Let that sink in. All right, if we took the entire property here, including the, you know, the mission house over here, if we had it fenced off, could we fit 1,400 horses? You know, I'm not talking about them having enough room to roam. And many of these chariots were pulled by two horses, not one. Okay, I just want you to think about, sometimes we read this thing, it's like, oh yeah, okay, I'm almost done with the chapter, you know, kind of thing. 1,400 chariots, and the chariots would outlast the horses. And what I mean by that is you could swap horses and keep going with the chariot and let the horses rest, right? So this wasn't all at one time. This is kind of a accumulation over time. But he had chariots and horsemen, 1,400 chariots, 12,000 horsemen. That's a lot of horsemen. And we're told in other accounts they had 40,000 stalls for horses. Okay? Solomon liked horses, apparently. Solomon was one of the few people on earth wealthy enough to actually afford horses, right? It used to be the common people had horses and only the wealthy had cars. Now it's the other way around, right? The commoners have cars, and only the wealthy people can afford horses. But nonetheless, you see here that he had all of these chariots and horsemen. Verse 27, the king made silver to be in Jerusalem as stones. In other words, it was common. It was not considered valuable. It was such a easy to obtain substance. And cedars as the sycamore trees. This is a little bit of hyperbolic speech, I think. It's just talking about the wealth of Solomon's day. Verse 28, Solomon had horses brought out of Egypt and linen yarn, and the king's merchants received the linen yarn at a price. A chariot came up and went out of Egypt for 600 shekels and a horse for 150. And so for all the kings of the Hittites and the kings of Syria did they bring them out by their means. Obviously, Solomon had more money. He could buy more of them. But he was just buying them at a certain rate every year. He had a standing purchase order. Okay? So, all of this was intended to be a testament to Solomon's God, right? In fact, the Queen of Sheba said, I've heard about your, you know, the name of the Lord your God, and I came to see it for myself. And, you know, there was a time at which that was the case. Solomon didn't end up that way. Beginning in chapter 11, we start to see him turn the corner. But we see here the blessings of God. So if I could say it this way, do material blessings of God guarantee prosperity? Or guarantee spiritual benefit? No. Do they guarantee, you know, a right walk with the Lord? No, it's great to have them. But Solomon is the primary example of you can have everything in the world, and that doesn't make you spiritual. What does that do with the health, wealth, and prosperity theology? I'll let you ponder that. All right, it's time for us to quit here. Let's pray. Thank you, Lord.